What's the solution that's going to produce the wow? It's the problem, and you told me the people you've interviewed recently, all of whom I know, and I think we all have the same problem. It's not enough to be good. They're not coming to hire you for a good job. They're coming to hire you for a great job. So that implies risk. And I think one of the issues we all have in this profession, if you're going to work at the top, is how much risk.
Welcome to The Light Lounge, the first podcast for lighting designers, creatives, and designers who work with light. My name is Thomas Nisch. Welcome back to The Light Lounge. I am very excited, especially because this week I speak with the fantastic Charles Stone, president of Fisherman and Stone, or also known under the abbreviation FMS. Well, what can I say? FMS has been established in 1971, and over the decades of experience, they have accumulated a history of working on over 5,000 projects, working with 1,200 clients, and having won hundreds of awards through their excellent work and design excellence. We spoke about what it takes to stay relevant, what it takes to establish and to maintain a company, to set the company and the culture up for success for now and for the future, especially in a time when companies and potential clients actually get in-house architects and in-house lighting designers. So how do we stay relevant? That lighting designers still have to take risks and what it involves. Why fashion also can be a part of success for a lighting designer. And I think this episode is very valuable for young lighting designers, but also and probably especially because of the wealth of experience for other lighting design business owners. And we start as always from the beginning. And now please welcome Charles Stone.
Well, I always say I was 11. And my parents took me to the local, the Harrisburg Community Theater in an attempt to keep me from becoming a juvenile delinquent. And I walked onto the stage, and that was it. So I did, in fact, as many of us in the profession will tell you, it was the theater that drew us to it. And right. That is reflected in the way we built this studio. Because we have some portion, it might be a third, it might be more sometimes, but approximately, a good population of all the designers here started in the theater, or at least that was their first love.
Right. Do you think this is a quality that should be reintroduced or also have a focus on education, where people just come?
Well, there's a good reason why they don't let me participate in the hiring process. Because if I look in their eyes and see sparkle and interest, okay. Remember, I would never get a job at this company or, frankly, almost any other company you're talking to because I was an English major.
Right.
And, in fact, I wrote about lighting and was fascinated by that aspect of it. I think what you're asking is very interesting. There isn't time. I serve on a curriculum committee at Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun, and the big lesson for me has been if you put something in, you have to take something out. So if you decided you wanted to include a theatrical lighting module for students in an AE program, that's all well and good, but what will you take out? You'll take out some quantitative study or some survey course about architecture, or we can never quite figure out. And of course, what happens is every year there's more and more published about light. There's more to learn. Frankly, LEDs are more complicated than any of the light sources I grew up with. I think that's a fair statement. And
absolutely,
so
yes.
How do we fit all this into a learning and educational setting?
Okay, that's a bigger question.
It's pretty big.
Let's maybe for the beginning start. Stick to sort of the timeline of like starting in theater and maybe being 11 years old.
It worked. I did not become a juvenile delinquent.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have an arrest record, nor have I served time. But it could have gone other ways.
Yeah. absolutely. So what were sort of your first tasks in the theater? Of being 11 years old and observing.
Carry this stuff over here to over there. And this is a gel, a theatrical gel. And of course, that would have been about 1966. And I think we had real gelatin gel in the drawers. And of course, that's all gone through plastics and polyesters. I don't know even what it's made of today.
Right.
But you learn so much from day one.
And an
11-year-old is fascinated that a gel could be called Bastard Amber.
Yeah.
And the story that went with it.
And I think still today, some of the gels and the color descriptions have like these beautiful, colorful explanations. Yeah.
Well, coming here in 1983 and joining Jules and Paul, Jules still has blues that are, that designers know, oh, Jules uses that blue.
Right.
It happens to be blues with, he likes blues with no green in them. Not to say that he doesn't like the other blues. And so we learn. And much of finding the right blue light has to do with what source you're using and what filter method you'll use. And that is a whole little subset of learning.
It's interesting how like a color can, how you can build your own identity with light, that you say, okay, I really like this one particular blue. Not that I'm discriminating all the other blues, but this is a
right.
part that I really like.
Well, that's very true. And now I'm reminded to ask Jules why there isn't one in the catalog called Jules Fisher Blue. I think he earned it. I'm going to ask him later today.
Yeah, that sounds like a good deal. So you were sort of in the theater environment for a couple of years. Carrying things from A to B, but also probably...
I don't think I knew there was anything such as architectural lighting, and there hardly was, frankly.
Right.
Until I'd graduated from university.
Right. So your work in the theater environment, did you already look specifically, so you later then went to Princeton to study, you mentioned, an English major with like a focus about lighting. Was it...
I was not known for my academic excellence, but fortunately some of it might have rubbed off. But you're touching on an interesting, going back to your first question about how should we, or should one consider more theater training and theater lighting training to be the whole lighting designer.
Right.
To bring students up to be whole lighting designers. Well, yes, I'm sure we should do that. The great advantage is that when you put your hands on theatrical instruments and you're actually, everybody knows this, I'm not saying anything that is new. When you hold that light fixture in your hands, you're actually able to shape the light, literally shape the light by manipulating the mechanical devices on the fixture, swinging it around, and playing with the dimmer, playing with color changing. Now suddenly you're in a world where you have immediate learning happening. And
right.
you're literally calibrating your eyes and your brain and your hands
right.
all around the light. Now, you can't do that in a textbook. The problem has been that people that come to us with only theatrical lighting training, well, sometimes I have the feeling they think they know all about lighting design, and they do, except that they don't know much about the quantities. And just because you've read a lot of plays and done lighting for them doesn't mean you know the top 50 architects in the world and what they're interested in. So lighting is a much bigger profession. You know, before you turned the mic on, we talked about for a minute how the profession is relatively small. And yet, I think that doesn't give credit to the influence.
Of course not, no.
And all of the adjunct professions that handle light, so many of those people don't have any training, even self-training. But that's quite a challenge and an interesting one.
Right.
I am rambling.
And that's totally fine, because that's sort of what we're here for. So being then now at Princeton, and you were basically consumed by light, having sort of your theater interest made into like a great deal of experience, and then you were reading about light, but then you sort of invented yourself, or did you convince your faculty to give you a very specific certificate?
I did. I don't think I was the first to have this certificate, but there was a small number.
Mm-hmm.
It could be smaller than 10. In those several years when there was a professor who's long gone now, Dan Seltzer was his name, and he wanted to create all aspects of a theater program at Princeton. Now, this has come to fruition, oh my, almost 50 years after he said it. And part of that was to recruit high school kids who were active in the theater as part of the strange cauldron. Before admission scandals, there were other ways of attracting students.
Right.
Anyway, so there I was as one of those kids who had – I'd done every high school play I could get my hands on and get involved in. And I'd been on the stage and backstage, and I had been a reader of poetry, and I had won awards and all of that kind of stuff. But what I was really interested in was lighting, which is, I think, surprised everyone, great to the great dismay of my parents probably at the time.
We will come to that later. Just for everyone to bring everyone on board, the certificate was called, I have it written down here, it was, help me please, it was called, the certificate was called, it was like for lighting design in theater and dance.
Something like that. For a certificate for lighting design in theater and dance. Oh, yes, and in that regard, I certainly was the first one. There were other people getting a certificate in theater and dance before there was such a program, because Princeton at that time would teach no skills. The idea of a liberal arts education was that you would learn nothing of use.
Right.
Perhaps how to think and express yourself.
Right.
And that was supposed to be a good education. I think it might have been. Well, I guess I was the first certificate, and I made the whole thing up.
Is this sort of the entrepreneurial spirit that you potentially...
It's easy to say that now, isn't it?
Right. But, I mean, you probably have tried to not to be part of the game and blend in. You have tried to just made your interest sort of to your path. Is this fair to say?
To the extent that I'm disruptive about authority, yes.
Yeah.
I had a conversation here in the office I think it might have been yesterday, with some of our rising leadership.
Uh-huh.
And it's procedural stuff.
Yeah.
And I reminded this person that we made the whole thing up. To a great extent, I made the whole thing up about what the titles mean and what the structure should be and what constitutes a team and what do they do. So it's... subject to revision for a better idea at any moment, which is the advantage of making it up. It probably isn't set in stone anywhere.
I think, yeah, that's a big deal of truth, that of course nothing is set in stone, but it's sometimes hard to keep sort of the poetry and the magic of light alive when you have to think about so many different things like the technologies and the difficulties that come with it. I read somewhere you received a letter from Sylvan Shimits.
That's a true story, yeah.
He explained, or he just laid out the different types of speed in different projects.
Well, he was a great... looking back, I have to say I saved the letter. I have it in a notebook of those things. And those listening who don't know, he founded a company called Elliptopar, which is a play on words of a parabolic ellipse, which is what you do to take a tubular source and create an asymmetric wash of light. Before refraction lenses and LEDs, that's what you did. You put the source in a reflector. And he created a company that's still around and has done very well. His daughter carries on, and Ali has created products that carry on in the same spirit. But the point is, I went to interview for a job, not knowing, I had no idea what to do. And he had two companies. He had the manufacturing company, and then I guess it was Sylvan Shimits Lighting Design or something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it had another name. I don't remember. But I went to see him, and I didn't get the job, but he wrote me that letter. He wrote me a letter that said, consider the difference between a career in the theater and a career in architectural lighting is that theater shows last for 4 days or maybe 40 weeks. And when you design for a building, you're hoping for 40 years at least. Words to that effect. Excellent advice and excellent reminder of the role of time.
Right.
And what I like to say, and here I'm cribbing from Dave DeLaura, professor, retired professor from University of Colorado, who taught lighting to generations of students. David always asked me, well, what does the role of memory in lighting design? And I think Cy was, when he wrote me that letter, was clipping the corners of that whole thinking, because time plays a part, and it does have an influence on how you approach a project. If it's gone in practical ways as well as sort of more interesting philosophical ways.
Right. Do you think in the conversation or in the interview you had with him, you made an appearance of being more interested in fast pace or in...
That's another good question. I don't know. I had shoulder length hair probably. I don't know. I can't remember. But I think when I... when I got these various interviews, which I look on it now and I wonder how I got them, but I think my recollection is it was easy. I actually think it probably was, because if somebody calls you and wants to do exactly what you do, of course you're going to see them. How many people did you pass on the street this morning like that? None. And that's, I always say to people who come here, to young people, I say, I know that you know how I measure my success? Do you know how I'm sure I'm successful? And the answer is, because when I got up this morning, I couldn't wait to get over here to talk to you. And there you have it. So if you turn 30, 40, 50, 60, and you still like what you do, you must be successful. It has nothing to do with fame and fortune. Because if you're not happy, I'm extremely happy. So that's that all ties together in the time question as well.
So the interview didn't work out, or the job interview
didn't
work out.
No.
How did you proceed? How did you?
I must have gone somewhere else. I got rejected all over the place until a good friend, Bill Lockwood, who I had worked for at Princeton in MacArthur Theater. I was his lackey. He planned the programming for. He created mostly Mozart. He planned the programming at Lincoln Center for 25 years, all the special events.
Wow.
Knew all the musicians, still does, around the world, and did this at MacArthur Theater in Princeton. And I was his assistant for a couple of years. And I was the guy that ordered up the piano and made sure that the timing was correct on the stage calls and that sort of thing. But he said, you ought to go meet Claude Engel in Washington.
Right.
And sent me to, Claude was giving a lecture at the Princeton campus. And I went to the lecture and I hung around after. And just like with why Cy gave me the interview, this guy walks up and says, hi, I'm Charles. And Bill Lockwood said I should talk to you and I really want to talk to you. And he said, sure, when are you coming to visit me in Washington? But I do remember going to the interview and I showed up on time in a suit, probably 10 o'clock in the morning. And he didn't see me until 5:30.
Because of the suit?
No, because he was busy. And I suppose, looking back on it, maybe that was the test. Would he stay all day or would he just walk away in disgust? So I got a job. And we all wore suits, it's hard to imagine, for a long time. But that was 1980.
How do you approach it in your office?
You mean...
You clearly don't wear a suit, but...
Well, some years ago, and it's maybe 15 or 20, it's probably 20 years ago, we didn't get a project we interviewed for. And it was the third time this had happened in... it was California. And I was friendly with the architect to whom we had made the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me months later, oh, well, they liked your firm and they liked you, but you were the most corporate-looking of the interviewees for the project, and they decided that was too corporate. like California was going a different direction. So then for a number of years, I wore these shirts that looked rather priestly. You remember them? They had no collars and you buttoned them all the way up.
Yeah.
I had a lot of those.
Yeah.
And then eventually I remember I was overseas. I was at a conference, the first Lux Pacifica, which was arranged by an Australian professor named Warren Julian. It was in Nagoya in Japan. And we're all there. I know that he'd collected, I don't know, a dozen lighting designers from around the world. Somehow I got the call. And there was a guy there called Tino Kwan, who still does lighting in Asia. I know Tino. In fact, we've worked together once or twice. And we're all these young guys, and he was wearing Armani Black. And I was drawn to it not so much because that's what everybody wears now, black. That was not it. It's because think of how little was in his suitcase.
Yeah.
So all of my friends roll their eyes at this, but I am known the world over for being the guy with the smallest bag.
And suddenly...
And I thought, that's the way. Just get black and figure it all out. And so no suit. And now I dress appropriately for the client. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think one might think that this conversation is kind of arbitrary, but I think it's actually very important because it all ties into the bigger understanding of how, what kind of signals do we send? How do we communicate to clients? What
Sure.
kind of values do we represent? And how do our clients perceive us in that case with the suit? As something too corporate, where
I'm always a little rumpled anyway. Well, I didn't look that good, and I don't look that good in a suit. I'm always a little rumpled. They can't fix me up.
Well, I think authenticity is a big part of it, but of course, there is something to it, the value of light, and we will come to it a little bit later again as well. So then you sort of. So apparently the letter from Sai is correct, right? I pronounce it right.
Sylvan Shimits called Sai.
Sylvan Shimits called Sai.
He passed away not too many years ago.
So apparently his letter about time and speed and a different persistence of your work in the world had made an impact on you, and then you sort of made the transition more into the architectural environment with Claude.
True, but it also had to do with opportunity, where I saw the opportunities. I don't remember the year exactly, but about the same time the movie All That Jazz came out.
I haven't seen it. What is it about?
It's a Bob Fosse movie, and it's about overdoing it and having the heart attack. And, of course, the theater will drive you there quickly. And actually, Jules Fisher has a cameo. He's doing the lighting
really?
For the show within the show.
Unbelievable.
And I think at the time I realized that maybe the life in the theater in the long term wasn't for me. I had opportunities to go on the road with the circus, believe it or not, or rock and roll as a roadie. And I just didn't think those things were going to be right for me. It looked like fun, and it seemed like a lot of money at the time because you get paid by the week, and they
right.
pay you a lot because you work 7 days. But I didn't think it was – I think I realized it wasn't going to make me happy in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, as well as the time scale of architecture and an interest in art, that drew me to think more broadly than theater.
Right.
That's not fair to the theater, to think in other medium.
Yeah. So – everyone who knows Claude Engel and everyone who's listening, I assume, are lighting designers, and who does not know him, go now and look him up, because his projects are, they couldn't be more known, larger in terms of scale, but also in a very, very subtle quality that is, for me, absolutely outstanding.
That's true, but there was a group of these characters, and in fact, most of them were in the room when the IALD was founded mm-hmm. at the Algonquin Hotel,
mm-hmm.
at the bar, I presume. And there's something like 15 original members. And Claude was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a collection of real interesting characters in addition to Paul Morantz, you had Jules Horton, David Mintz, Leslie Wheel, and in Japan, Motoko Ishii, and I think probably Motoko and Leslie were pioneers for women in lighting. Maybe some others. Derek Phillips, who just passed away a few years ago from the UK. You know, my career has spanned the years when I met all these guys and gals and saw their work, have been to some of their projects with them in many countries. So that I'm the luckiest guy walking, because well, it's been explained to me, lighting was, after World War II, lighting education had a hiccup. And so the profession, you might credit Richard Kelly making it possible to have a profession again, mm-hmm. of independent lighting design. So lighting designers that aren't selling product, or shall I say product salesmen who aren't doing the lighting for free while they sell your product.
Right.
That still exists all over the world. And all the people's names I've said, and indeed our practice, we're all working at the, certainly in the top half of projects that even think about having someone help with the lighting design, and probably in the top quarter or quintile.
Right.
Because who else would pay for someone to do that but the only the best projects?
How was the spirit of these 15 sort of characters that...
Well, they're just normal people, but they all had different stories about how they came to lighting, some of which I know. And some had engineering backgrounds, some were salesmen and decided, you know, it was more fun to be the lighting designer.
Right.
And some had... just as there is today, and I find it very strange, but it's true that you go to any lighting conference in the world and all the lighting designers are also nice to each other and we like each other and there's this strange camaraderie. And strange is a fair word for it. And it's quite enjoyable. I have the additional privilege of having been the president of the association, the International Association of Lighting Designers, and that gave me even greater access to so many people, and I made so many friends, and I've been all around the world and see them, and we've collaborated with, we started to count yesterday, we were looking up something, more than a dozen firms have collaborated with us on projects around the world, even in the U.S. once or twice. But, and I say that simply because one of the primary reasons for collaboration is you're dealing in another culture, regulatory situation, local environment, mm-hmm. and it adds adds to the argument that we ought to collaborate.
Right.
And that does happen too. So it's been interesting to watch this go from a few dozen practitioners
to a few hundred.
I think we're well over 1,000 legitimate independent lighting designers in the world.
Right.
And that's fascinating. I've seen that in my lifetime.
Do you think everyone is so friendly? Is this a positive? Is it this a positive thing, or should we be maybe more? I don't want to say edgy, but maybe more distinct in.
Oh, I'd rather the way it is than not.
I appreciate it very much.
Yeah. You saw it in your days,
right.
Working in consulting. It's a little strange to explain to people who haven't experienced it.
Yeah.
And that's good fun. I would rather have that than not have it.
And it's...
I think that the challenge has been, we count our studios in Seattle and New York make a business. So we are artists, we are innovators, we are scientists, and we are also business people. And we combine all that together.
Right.
Otherwise, we've been here almost 50 years.
Yeah.
And we didn't do that by making bad business decisions or ugly projects. So that's, I think you have to have a balance with that. I think that's sometimes missing in our feel-good parties in the lighting industry. I mean, having said that, I'd still rather have the parties than not have them.
I understand. But I think it makes sense that we sort of maybe I'm oversimplifying here, but maybe it makes sense to stick together as long as possible until we have like our base is much stronger, until people can maybe more diversify.
Well, I think that's a good argument, but maybe we should stick together anyway. Maybe we're a different kind of profession altogether.
I'm on the same page. I was just trying to challenge the good field party. I like the word
actually,
you used.
I think we can make this work. I would like to see more. I think I paid my dues, and I'm proud of it, and I'm grateful for it. And it disappoints me when I see people with 2 or 3 years experience leave a practice, a bigger practice, and set up their own shop. And it disappoints me because they don't know what they're missing. And I've studied with Jules, Paul, primarily Paul, and those early few years, 3 years, only 3 years with Claude. And again, I'm the luckiest guy walking. If you work for the best, you're going to learn a couple of things. And if I had a message to the young designers listening, it would be, you can't tell someone to be patient. That's terrible. But on the other hand, there's value in those early years of making coffee, and we used to go make copies. We don't do that anymore. And there's value in that, and there's value in hanging around late at night and watching the design happen.
Right.
And I think that gets sometimes forgotten, perhaps.
Right.
And people get restless and go off and start their own business, and they can compete very well, and they're cheap, and it drags a whole profession down in a way. In an interesting way, because it averages down the level of expertise. And I see it at the other side. I go into a meeting and the expectation is low in some areas and it should be much higher. So we're having to reset expectations. That's very interesting.
So now, and we are already way deeper in our conversation, but at some point
we've fallen off your outline. I'm pretty sure.
It's totally fine.
Disaster.
That's totally fine. So then after Claude Engel, you met Paul Marantz and Jules Fischer.
Well, I met a girl too, and we've been married for 4 years, something like that. And she was in New York and I was in Washington. We had the Amtrak romance.
What is that?
That's when you ride the train every weekend.
Oh, God. I understand, yeah.
And I had reasons to come to New York. And her family are all in the movie business. So before I knew it, I had introductions around. And most of these people had no use for me. But I had several introductions, and then I finally got serious about doing my own research. And indeed, when I got an interview over here, I had gone to see, Uptown. A family friend, Kimberly's family's friend, sent me to Danny Franks, who was Emero Fiorentino's partner, and forever was the guy who did the work. And Danny sent me to Roger, and they said, "Well, we don't have any jobs for you, but you should go down and see Jules or Bob Davis, who was at the time running the theater consulting side of this of these collected businesses here." Mm-hmm. And Bob Davis said, "Well, I don't have any work for you, but you ought to talk to Jules." And so Jules came in, "Well, I don't have any work for you, but you should talk to Paul." So I got passed around. That was in a period of like 2 days. I got passed around. It was Roger Morgan. Sorry. He was a Broadway lighting designer and also consultant. Uh-huh. Because in those days, the guys who were doing the lighting on Broadway and sets, and it still must be true, to really make a living, you needed another part of your life to have a different time scale to match up with Broadway, and that would typically be consulting.
Right.
Which I guess, frankly, is what Jules ended up doing here. Mm-hmm. But I was passed around. I hadn't thought that you've got that story out of me. I had forgot all about it. I don't know if it's that interesting, but Yeah, take the first opportunity and then you get sent to the next guy. And so I went down the line like that, and we were over on a block from here at the corner of 5th Avenue and 18th Street where the office was for many years. And then I remember, and then Paul came in and I showed, I had a giant roll as a portfolio, all hand drawings, of course.
Wow.
And he doesn't remember, and I try to ask a couple of questions like this because I'm trying to put perspective on it all. But I remember rolling it out, and they were all duly impressed. But when they probably weren't impressed, it was more like, okay, well, this kid can draw a little bit, so we should hire him because we need somebody. That's probably the truth of it. And that was fun. So then I started work up here in 1983, up here being moving from Washington. I'd been in Washington just 3 years and 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember that. And then I started here, and one thing led to another, and I'm still here.
Do you think you're, and I can clearly tell just by looking at you, what kind of an energy you radiate, basically, that do you think your sort of happiness, just loving what you do, then propelled you to becoming partner and now the principal of
maybe FMS? I'm out of control because I really like what I do. And now it's changed because quite not only consciously, I mean, some of it's getting older and evolving and learning how to grow up, but also consciously we are in a process here to bring up the younger generations the word is not delegate, it is not distribute. It is empower, really, so that you said early when you were introducing me that I run a company. I really don't. If I'm running the company, we have a problem.
Sure.
So they all run the company, and I try to help a little. That's really important. It's quite different from running the company. And I think you could be a consulting business and disappear when you retire or bad things happen to you. And that would be that. And I'm sure we could just fill your notebook with examples of that. But to create so if I'm second generation, we're into the third and fourth generation here. And that's not accidental. That takes work. So that's one of the things I work on every day. That's fun too.
That sounds, I need to process this a little bit because I think it's so rich what you just said about how to empower people. If you are sort of all the time like emergency managing and managing people, micromanaging, then, and you don't seem like the micromanager at all, that's probably you are in the position you are.
I used to be. And I still know I'll drive them crazy with the detail I know. But that's just showing off mostly. But what you say is exactly right. And I'm learning this, and we're practicing it, and we're putting it in place structurally in our own organization. That's too strong a word. The process of – and it fits with the times. Actually, more importantly, it fits with the changing world. And what do I mean? Well, there's screens everywhere. Well, I embrace that. You just walk around the office, you'll see that.
Right.
Nathan gave you a tour, I assume. So – we've just completed a renovation around here, which is geared to the future. Every decision we made in the renovation was not about me, but what I think it should be is about what we judged to be part of a future thinking firm. And what we needed to be like. What do we look like in 5 years, and what does the office look like to support that? So everything from the acoustical treatments you've seen to lots of big screens and different kinds of collaboration spaces. Well, we all do it in our work. Anybody that works in, what do they call it, the office workspace environment is hearing this and doing it all the time. And so are we. We have clients. And in fact, so many of the ideas that are on display here in our little renovation, which for those listening is not particularly high end. It has a rough and tumble loft, midtown
charm.
Yeah, well, I never thought of it as charming, but we cleaned it up and painted it. Okay, it's charming that it's painted, but it's rough. I mean, there are not a lot of finished ceilings, etc. Yeah. But my point is the things we have done are all about the future. Because when I bring a young person through the office who might end up working here, whether they get the job or not, you'd like them to say, wow, that place was cool. I could work there.
Yeah.
And that's hard to figure out. We had fun doing it.
You probably don't like the description, but I think this is setting up your company or your team for the future and trying to just try to help where you are. I think this describes like the position of a great leader of a company.
Well, that remains to be seen, but it's a combination of what's best for the company, and generally speaking, that's what's best for me. So there's self-interest involved too. And I can't say it on the radio, but I have an expression that I use that goes something like this, where, you know, someday you leave this earth and you would like your colleagues to come stand around and remember you for one last few minutes while they lower the box, right? What would you like them to be doing? Remembering that you were good to them?
Yeah.
And in every possible way? Or something else? So, and that doesn't motivate me every morning, but, you know, you might as well try to get it right.
Right. So we already touched base on what sort of success means for you, and maybe we can, and probably everything is learning and we are approaching sort towards the end, but everything, of course, you probably would approach as a learning, but have there been moments where you thought, wow, this is a challenging time, where you really had to think about how do I solve this and how?
For sure. Daily. Daily, really. How to solve a lighting problem, what's the solution that's going to produce the wow? It's the problem, and you told me the people you've interviewed recently, all of whom I know, and I think we all have the same problem. It's not enough to be good. They're not coming to hire you for a good job. They're coming to hire you for a great job. So that implies risk. And I think one of the issues we all have in this profession, if you're going to work at the top, is how much risk. And it could be as simple as, should I wash that wall in this manner or that technical solution? You know, mm-hmm. It could be as simple as that. Or do I really want to use this particular adjustable magical LED source in this environment of salt water? Are they going to be calling me in 6 months? You know, but it would be the best lighting solution. So there are practicalities and design. That tension, I think, is interesting. I mean, that's what's so interesting. But it's also daily challenge as stressful.
But these seem like very controllable risks, right? Because the
That way when they work out.
Exactly. But of course, the worst thing can happen is like a financial risk you take. Have there been things where you thought, wow, okay, this is sort of beyond financial risk?
Well, we run a tight ship. So right. What does that mean? In all ways. We know what it costs to do it, and if people don't want to pay us to do it, then we won't be doing that job.
Right.
And you have to calibrate that against what the market will be interested in. Financial risk on a design decision. Well, we have some serious internal procedures to prevent errors. And they work pretty well.
Yeah.
And they've been polished over many years.
Right.
And I'm absolutely fanatical about them.
Would you agree that the fees for the design consultants could still rise in order to allow for more exploration, for more research, for more development, in order to be maybe not always like on the edge and maybe a little bit more sort of on the forefront develop things? Or well, is this actually the case for you? Or
well, I share that sentiment exactly that you pose. However, I think there's a much larger thing going on. You see it as big companies essentially become their own architects. Some big tech companies mm-hmm. and other companies mm-hmm. are bringing it all in-house by purchasing architecture firms and other service firms. That you have that happening. You have the expected benefits of Revit. The expected benefits of the all-LED world. So there are a lot of pressures that all come back to fees. I don't sit around worrying much about it. It is a limit to growth. I would say that it has limited. I can't speak for the whole profession. I can only speak for our business. It limits our ability to grow because there's only so much work at the top.
Right.
And I do think that is the case and has been for some time and continues to be. Or maybe I'm just not very good at growing. I don't know which is true.
And maybe this is, a larger conversation to have to sort of determine the value of light we bring to projects. And you said in another interview that the client only determines sort of the success of your work if he likes it or not.
Well, that's what we all say. We all say that's the only metric that matters.
Is it true?
Well, of course it's true. So you have to offer something more, and we do.
Because there is this sort of magical moment of light that is really, really, it's not tangible. People can feel it, but do you back it up by your reference, by your portfolio, or by the way you communicate to the client that you bring?
Probably all of those things. Hmm. I wish I knew the secret sauce. I think we've built studios in Seattle and New York that have people who are passionate about the work and excellence, and they are committed to it at a very high level of better than satisfactory completion. And except for the fact that they're all lighting designers and have the same attributes we've been discussing about liking other lighting designers and light, mm-hmm. we all have the same pair of eyes, and our brains and eyes kind of work the same way. I think the differentiators are not so much. Yes, there is such a thing as better design, good design, appropriate design, and we try to do that. At the same time, if you can't back it up with a process and a team that is happy, learning, changing, innovating, it won't last. So the thing that we have that nobody else has is, and there's a book on the table here, is a legacy of projects. It's not 1 year or 10 years, it's a long time. And it's not, I don't think we're smarter than anybody else. I think we've got some pieces of the puzzle put together exactly right in the way that we operate as a studio, our design processes, the way we talk to and listen to clients. And yes, maybe we are pretty good at the right chemistry of research and studying precedent and listening to the architect. Maybe we're good at those things too. But I think we're only good at them because it's part of our process. So that's a point of view.
In terms of communication, and we are about to finish the interview because I could continue for a long time with you, but I want to be mindful with your time. In terms of communication, what would you tell your 11-year-old self? Looking back, would you say...
I should have studied harder.
What studied?
I probably should have... I don't have a master's degree. I probably should have gone and gotten some kind of master's in art or maybe lighting. That's what I would tell myself. Because you can't... It's too late now. I'm not doing it now.
Well, you probably study...
I really wasn't that good at school, okay?
You said you were not known for be a good student. What were you known for?
Being in the theater.
Being in the theater. Well, that's maybe more worth and more education than a school can offer.
Oh, you can say that now. They couldn't say it then.
So,
but I wrote all of the major term papers in college, and they were all a way to... They were really writing about light, which, of course, made them, as you have used the word, authentic. So I managed to pass.
Right. So after your parents sent you into theater in order not that you become like a criminal or you end up in prison, then you were in theater and in lighting.
Every night.
And
they had to come pick me up at midnight. I was 12.
And they had doubts that you would make like a living out of it.
I'm sure they did. It wasn't until my parents used to say at Christmas or holidays when I would go visit them, and I really left. I went to Princeton young. I was 17. I guess I was clever on the test. But I would go see them, and they would say, my mother would just blurt it out, don't you want to go to medical school or business school, whatever it was. Everyone in the family is a lawyer, a counselor, except me. So they all thought, oh, well, maybe he'll eventually come around and go to law school. Well, none of these things happened. I was 40. I was just turning 40. And actually, Kimberly was with me, and we were in Australia. And I had a meeting coinciding with my parents going on a trip. They're world travelers. I have the travel gene from my parents. And they're alive and well as I speak this morning. And they have just slowed down from traveling at the age of 91 and 92.
Wow.
They have just reached a point where it's just a little too much to drag the suitcases. But anyway, there we were. And the architects I was working with, some of them had second jobs, I guess. And one of them, I guess he was friends with, or he was working in the restaurant at the Park Hyatt, which had a fantastic view of the Sydney Opera House. So I took my parents and some of their friends to dinner in a slightly elevated kind of large bay window with a big round table with a view of the opera house. And there I was on work with my wife with me. And so this is 25 years ago. And my mom that night, she said for everyone to hear, she said, well, I guess it's okay if you stay with this lighting. I love that story.
That's amazing. Well, I think you clearly made it from moving park hands from A to B, and now, yeah, having worked on all these amazing projects, and
none of which we even spoke of.
And I think that's okay, because, of course, we want to hear what's and who's involved in the amazing projects, like the tallest building in the world in Dubai. But I think there's a different, like a much deeper quality.
That's a good example to talk about for a moment in the following way. We won an award for it, or a couple maybe, and that's all very nice. But when they came and said, well, we'd like to include everyone, we have a policy that if you're not working here when we win the award, you're not going to be on it. That's my policy.
Mm-hmm.
I can explain that in detail. It's serious stuff. But anyway, we did count the number of people who worked on the project, who'd had their hands on it. Now, the young guy who did most of the work happens to be our associate principal, Kevin Frary, in the Seattle, who runs our Seattle office.
Mm-hmm.
But 32 people worked on the project. So when you think of these large, and I'm looking at the book on the table, the larger projects in there, it's not one or two, it's not Paul Morantz or me or a couple of people. It's 10 or 20 or even 30 people who worked on it. And that's significant in this conversation, which has at times talked a little bit about process, and you've mentioned leadership and studio and longevity and legacy.
Right.
Well, in order to make that happen, think of what we had to teach those 30 people. And think of the consistency required and the single-minded purpose of concept and error checking and all the things that go into getting to excellence.
Right.
So when you look at those big projects, I never I hardly ever associate them with one person. Even the ones, Paul Morantz's long history of working one-on-one with I.M. Pei, and yet, if Paul were here and looking at, sitting, he's probably down the hall, if he were sitting here looking in the book with us and look at some of the Pei, Cobb-Fried, I.M. Pei projects, you know, it's quite interesting because he would start talking about the five other people in the office who worked on it.
Right.
So we have a way of thinking about that, which is, sure, I've enjoyed some visibility, and yes, I represent I carry the flag.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're a little different that way. Some of the other practices you've mentioned, I have the depth, what do they call it in sports, a deep bench,
mm-hmm.
That I'm very proud of because they've all done it.
Right.
And we're very aware of that when we talk about the work.
We leave it at that, Charles. It was an absolute pleasure. And everyone who's listening, I can only, I hope the amazing company came through and the personality came through the conversation. I have only my highest recommendation, and I'm truly impressed. And I am grateful as well, as a big part of being, not successful, but I'm very grateful and thankful for the conversation and the time.
Thanks for your time. And everybody, thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. And that was the amazing conversation I had with Charles Stone, president of Fisher Morantz Stone. And I could not be more excited. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, because being in Charles' environment could not be more inspiring through his energy and experience accumulated in the sense of lighting, but also in business and creating and influencing people. Okay, so my top three in the lighting design of lighting design projects that FMS has influenced and shaped in the world. Number one is, of course, the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world with SOM. I think it doesn't get higher than that. Number two is, I think, a project that cannot be topped or overcome in terms of meaning, how powerful lighting is and how powerful lighting can be to communicate meaning, love, hope, unity, that we are all one in one world. I'm, of course, talking about the National September 11th Memorial Museum. I speak about the plaza. I speak about how the lighting is integrated into the two voids that are filled with water and light, basically. Absolutely fantastic and amazing. And if you should be in New York, please go and check it out, because here the true power of light is transformed in its best in one place. Okay, and then the last but not least, number three, is the Public Hotel that I absolutely love. I think the wow effect Charles spoke about is there, one of the strongest. When you enter the place, approaching the escalator, like the sequence of experience, absolutely amazing. I hope you enjoyed this week's Light Lounge, and if you haven't done so, please check into the other episodes that are online. Very excited to speak to you next week again, and so long, please stay lit.